provided by Thomas Allgaier and Fredis, based on the most relevant posts on LinkedIn about private equity in CW 2627. Fredis is a B2B market research company working with enterprises to optimize their campaigns with account and executive insights far beyond AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking a deep dive into the top private equity trends that were really buzzing across LinkedIn in calendar weeks 26 and 27. We've sifted through quite a stack of posts from industry leaders, pulling out the most important nuggets of knowledge for you, really trying to give you that shortcut to being well-informed. Okay, let's unpack this.
That's right. And what's clear from, you know, looking across all these posts is that investors are actively navigating this macro uncertainty. They're doubling down on technology, sharpening those operational playbooks, and refining capital strategies just to stay competitive. So the goal here really is to give you a clear picture of what's truly shaping the PE landscape right now. Super valuable if you're in M&A, private equity itself, venture capital, or consulting. What's truly fascinating, I think, is how sustainable returns are now hinging more on digital capability and like disciplined value creation. It's not just about leverage anymore.
Yeah, that's a critical shift, isn't it? So to really break this down, we're going to explore six key storylines that really jumped out from the source material. We'll kick off with the transformative impact of tech and AI, then pivot to the renewed emphasis on operational excellence. After that, the evolving landscape of capital and financing. Then we'll look at new market strategies and portfolio allocation, changing demands for talent and leadership, and finally, the broader macro outlook. So let's kick things off with that major theme, the one really dominating the conversation, technology, particularly AI and private equity.
Indeed. And what's striking is, you know, the shift from AI being just a concept to, well, actual repeatable practice. Industry voices are really pushing for established AI operating models and central hubs for sharing tools and benchmarks. Anil Kumar, for instance, really emphasizes this need for a centralized AI hub. The idea is for portfolio companies to share best practices, share tools, and sort of accelerate implementation across different maturity levels. It's about creating that multiplier effect, you know?
Okay, so if it's moving from concept to practice, where exactly are firms seeing the early wins with AI? Is it like mostly back office efficiency stuff, or are we seeing more strategic frontline applications too?
Oh, it's definitely strategic now. Deal teams are embedding AI across the entire deal lifecycle. We're talking sourcing, diligence, even exit planning. And this isn't just about speed. It's about cutting cycle times and really sharpening price discovery. Mooj.a, for example, points out AI is becoming a kind of secret weapon, dramatically slashing screening times, uncovering hidden gems for deal sourcing, especially using NLP.
NLP.
Yeah. And Mark Standen elaborates on how AI is streamlining market research, risk assessment, financial analysis. We're seeing those early wins reported particularly in media, healthcare, and retail portfolios.
And it's not just the deal teams, right? I imagine AI is also having a pretty significant impact on the core operations within the portfolio companies themselves. That must be where a lot of immediate cost savings come in.
Exactly. Tom Van Wees highlights operational AI as a really significant and often untapped lever for value creation. He cites examples like automating back office functions, think accounts payable, that can cut costs by a pretty substantial 20-40% and directly improve EBITDA. That's, you know, your core profit.
The numbers.
Yeah. And Cuauhtemoc Velasco Aznar notes that many portfolio companies are adopting cloud solutions like SAP Public Cloud Edition to modernize their data architecture, making it scalable for value creation. But there's a crucial point from Leon Mandelbaum, who warns about the critical need for structured output in AI analysis. Without it, you risk building these expensive black box data silos instead of truly connected searchable data sets you can use for trend analysis and like comparative due diligence.
Right. That distinction makes a lot of sense. You need usable data, not just more data. But if it's so foundational, there must be a real risk for those firms or portfolio companies that dismiss AI.
Isn't there?
It feels like it's moving beyond nice to have.
Oh, absolutely. Sasha Van Hulst gives a pretty stark warning here. He says, dismissing AI as just hype risks a genuine structural disadvantage. He even posits that AI is becoming the new web entry point, which could lead to significant lost web traffic and ultimately revenues for businesses that don't adapt. It's a foundational shift, really, not just some trendy tool.
Wow. Okay, so that kind of thinking leads to some really intriguing predictions about the future structure of PE firms themselves, doesn't it?
Hmm.
Could we see a complete reimagining of what a firm looks like powered by this tech?
It's quite profound, actually, the potential implications. Jeremy Rosmarin predicts the rise of these lean, tech-enabled, maybe one or two partner funds.
And these smaller outfits could compete effectively with the traditional multi-partner platforms. The thinking is AI drastically cuts the overhead for sourcing, underwriting, reporting. It could potentially, you know, democratize access to institutional capital a bit and shift success from just check size to deeper value creation. So while technology is clearly a huge game changer, our sources reveal an equally powerful shift in how PE firms are creating value. It's this move, really decisively, beyond pure financial engineering to a deeper focus on operational alpha. Lee McCabe makes this point quite strongly. He even says, the golden age of private equity financial engineering is over.
That's a bold statement, certainly provocative.
Yeah.
If that golden age is over, what does this focus on operational alpha look like in practice? Is it just about finding efficiencies or is there more to it?
Oh, it's much more than just efficiency. General partners, GPs, are now mandating really rigorous execution disciplines and agile talent models inside their portfolio companies. Felix von Obernitz notes that operational value creation has truly become the top priority. It's number one. And Lee McCabe emphasizes that the firm's really excelling here. They bring in operators early on. They build cross-portfolio capabilities in things like pricing and procurement, and they arm their teams with real-time data. It's about unlocking growth, often in flat or fragmented markets, not just trimming fat.
Right, proactive growth. And what about the so-called soft side of operations, like company culture? Does that actually impact the bottom line, or is it more of a theoretical concern?
Well, according to Vinay Raman, cultural misalignment is actually being quantified now as direct EBITDA leakage.
Really?
Leakage?
Yeah, meaning it's directly eating into the core profitability of the business. He even says the culture warning light is blinking. It's that serious. And Kit Lyle talks about the culture shock that clash when legacy management meets investor-grade expectations. It leads to this silent friction that can totally derail value creation after the deal closes. So yeah, very much a quantifiable financial issue.
That makes sense. This level of operational intensity must put a lot of pressure on CFOs, doesn't it? Their role has to be evolving super rapidly to meet these demands.
It absolutely does. Christian Sanford reveals something pretty staggering. 74% of PE sponsors believe their portfolio CFOs are actually underperforming, particularly in value creation.
74%. Wow.
Yeah. Sponsors are now urging attention to immediate, tangible value levers. Things like cash agility, product-led growth, not just broad cost-cutting anymore. Susanna Madden adds that public company CFOs who transition to PE, they need a laser focus on inbound and outbound cash, really understanding that cash conversion cycle, not just looking at EBITDA. Nicola Grimes also highlights the increased complexity overall for CFOs.
And you mentioned product-led growth. So it's not just about cutting costs anymore, right? It's about how you strategically grow the business.
Precisely. David Mackey states that PE has decisively shifted focus from cost-cutting to product-led value creation. He emphasizes that product is the new playbook. This covers everything from developing better products to unlock new revenue, using smart product strategy for margin defense, and really leaning into innovation as a key competitive edge. It's about building, not just buying and cutting.
And interestingly, some voices are even arguing for a return to more fundamental, maybe entrepreneurial roots in PE, focusing on the basics of building good businesses.
That's a really interesting thread, yeah. Cade Thomas, for one, argues that private equity needs to actively sort of salvage its reputation by embracing proactive, thoughtful entrepreneurialism, prioritizing people, process, customer experience over that short-term financial engineering focus. It's kind of a call to return to the historical roots of PE, you know, where investors partnered with founders to supercharge growth and build lasting value.
Okay, let's switch gears now. Let's talk about capital and financing. That's undergoing some really interesting shifts, too, especially in this higher rate world we're in. I've heard some rumblings about certain types of debt making a comeback.
You're probably thinking about PIK interest in kind or PIK debt. Brian Wolf notes its resurgence in sponsor-backed companies. Essentially, it allows borrowers to defer interest payments by just adding them to the loan balance. He warns this could be a bit of a canary in the coal mine for future restructurings and defaults. It feels a bit like the lead up to the global financial crisis, potentially. Borrowers might struggle to grow into these capital structures later on.
Right. Kicking the can down the road, potentially. So with those concerns hanging out there, what alternatives are being leveraged to navigate this tricky financing environment?
Well, private credit structures are increasingly stepping into the breach. They're helping bridge valuation gaps, securing fixed rates before maybe more monetary tightening happens. Bruce Richards and Joanne Y highlight how private equity and private credit are really complementary levers now. They provide both resilience and downside protection. Private credit specifically offers more, let's say, deterministic returns and predictable cash flows, which is a huge advantage for LPs trying to manage duration and liquidity.
Okay, predictability is key there. And how are exit strategies being reassessed, especially when the market is so dynamic, maybe even unpredictable?
Yeah, exit timing is definitely being reassessed in this higher rate world. Alisa Wood emphasizes this. She notes that investors are favoring really granular manager selection over just making broad sector calls. Experienced managers are focusing on planning early, embracing multiple ways to win an exit, getting creative, and intensely driving value creation right up to the end. It's less about just timing the market and much more about actively manufacturing the exit opportunity. All right, moving on to broader market strategy and portfolio allocation. We're seeing some new frameworks emerging for accredited investors, trying to balance risk and return in these shifted markets.
Okay, what kind of frameworks are we talking about? Is it just like tweaking the old 60-40 model or something more fundamental changing?
It definitely looks like an evolution beyond that traditional 60-40 portfolio. Howard Marks, for example, proposes a 50-30-20 portfolio framework for accredited investors. So 50% equities, 30% fixed income, and then a pretty significant 20% chunk dedicated to alternative assets.
20% in alternatives.
Yeah. And within that 20%, he suggests 10% for pre-IPO investing and another 10% for other alts like private credit, real estate, maybe even gold. The whole aim is enhancing returns and reducing risk in this new landscape.
Interesting allocation. Beyond that broad structure, where are PE firms finding those high conviction themes? Maybe specific sectors that look particularly resilient or offer strong growth?
Yeah, high conviction themes are definitely emerging in some vital areas. Energy is one, highlighted by Jordan Pinnett, driven by rising demand for reliable power, especially from all those AI data centers.
Ah, the AI connection again.
Right. And Brenda Salas and Igor Perpetuligny also point directly to infrastructure and those data centers as key growth spots. Alan Ayers notes growing investment in urgent care assets. And Martin Grindrod highlights investments across healthcare in the Asia-Pacific region, hospital chains, pharma, diagnostics, health tech. It seems like they're really seeking robust essential services, things people need regardless of the economy.
Makes sense. And geographically, it seems there's a strong pull towards certain regions too, indicating some maybe interesting shifts in where capital's flowing.
Definitely. Igor Perepolikny states that European stability is actually attracting fresh inflows right now. We're seeing major capital commitments from big names like Blackstone, the Carlyle Group, KKR. What's driving it? Apparently undervalued assets, maybe some defense sector upside, and just overall institutional stability compared to other regions. Meanwhile, Philip Bahoshi notes that emerging venture markets think MENA, Africa, Southeast Asia, they continue to command specialist capital. Local investors like Saudi Arabia's PIF are being highly active there.
Okay, interesting regional dynamics. And finally, under this theme, there's a fascinating trend around who can access private equity now. It sounds like it's maybe broadening out a bit.
Yeah, this is a really significant shift for the industry, potentially. Bryan Smith and Nishant Sondhi highlight that PE is becoming more accessible to retail investors. This is happening through innovative platforms and also some forward-leaning regulatory changes. It's moving beyond its traditional exclusivity, you know, opening up new opportunities for savvy accredited investors to get access to control, cash flow, tangible value from real businesses that were previously pretty much out of reach for them.
Right, democratizing it a bit.
Yeah.
Okay, shifting gears now to talent and leadership.
Yeah.
With all these new demands, the focus on operational value, digital fluency, what kind of operators are PE firms actually looking for these days? Has the ideal profile changed much?
Oh, it has definitely evolved. Search mandates for those critical roles, CEO, COO, CFO, they increasingly favor operators who bring not just financial smarts, but also strong digital fluency and crucially, hands-on execution credentials. Ryan Laughlin and William B., mentioned via Alex Mull, emphasize this need for agile talent management, focusing on preserving and redeploying talent toward priority initiatives rather than just, you know, reactive cost-cutting or layoffs.
So finding the right people and keeping them focused, is there a kind of playbook for top performers in these PE-backed companies, something repeatable that sponsors look for in CEOs?
Yes, apparently there is. The 5Maya model for repeat CEO performance is gaining traction. Sponsors are actively seeking these scalable leadership playbooks. Ellen Gonsenhauser points this out, and it's based on extensive research into CEOs who consistently delivered exceptional exit multiples. So yes, they're looking for that repeatable success pattern in driving value.
Okay, the 5X model. And post-acquisition, what's truly crucial for capturing that value? Is it just about implementing the plan, or is there a human element that maybe gets overlooked sometimes in the integration?
The human element is absolutely critical. Often, it's the real difference maker. Kit Lyle and Mullen Pat Warden both highlight that alignment between the legacy management team and the new owners is decisive for post-close value capture. It requires a significant shift from just business as usual to truly understanding and meeting PE's investor-grade expectations. Mullen Pat Warden specifically emphasizes the CEO's role in driving value through partnerships and collaboration with specialists. It's about getting everyone pulling in the same direction.
Alignment is key. Got it.
Okay, finally, let's broaden our view one last time to the macro and outlook. It's definitely a complex picture out there, sort of a mix of, let's say, cautious optimism and a lot of strategic adaptation as firms navigate what is clearly a challenging, but also, importantly, an opportunity-rich environment.
Right. So what are the latest surveys telling us about market sentiment? Are firms feeling maybe a bit more confident now than they were a few months ago, even with all the volatility?
Well, the surveys we looked at from places like Alvarez and Marsal, with insights from Nick Alvarez and Deloitte via Wolftone, they do signal a sort of cautious optimism. Deal volume did moderate back in Q1 FUT 25, but the long-term return expectations, they seem to remain largely intact. Omar Mahmoud from KPMG also supports this outlook, suggesting that despite maybe a cool down in deal activity, the long-term prospects for the sector still look quite promising.
Okay, cautious optimism. And how is private capital itself being framed in the bigger economic picture? Is it seen as like a driving force for recovery, or is it more reactive in this environment?
It's actually being framed quite positively. Preston Llewellyn and Igor Perepelikny frame private capital as a significant driver of the U.S. post-pandemic recovery, and even as a stabilizer in Europe's currently shifting order. It's attracting unprecedented investor attention despite all the volatility, which indicates it's playing a pretty proactive, maybe even foundational role in economic health right now.
Interesting. So what's the core advice then for managers looking ahead? Given all this complexity, the shifting dynamics we've just talked through, what's the strategic imperative?
The outlook briefings we saw from people like Ahmed Reda and Stephen Fleming, they strongly urge managers to treat this volatility not as a deterrent, something to shy away from, but actually as a source of potentially mispriced opportunities.
See opportunity in the chaos.
Exactly. The emphasis is squarely on agility, boldness, and opportunism in this challenging environment. Juan Rivera adds that this climate absolutely demands operational rigor, a clear focus on sustainable growth, and again, that strategic use of new technologies. And just quickly, Inderpreet Kaur also highlights the recent UK Stewardship Code 2026 reforms. They aim to enhance long-term value creation for private companies, partly by reducing the reporting burden and providing more clarity, so regulation is adapting too.
If you enjoyed this deep dive, remember, new episodes drop every 2 weeks. You can also check out our other editions on venture capital, M&A, and strategy and consulting. It's clear the private equity landscape is incredibly dynamic, demanding that blend of tech prowess, operational rigor, and strategic flexibility. We really hope these insights help you navigate it all with confidence. Thank you for joining us, and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss our next deep dive.
Indeed. And as we've explored today, you know, AI's transformative potential isn't just about making large firms more efficient. It seems like it could actually be reshaping the very structure of the industry itself, which leaves us with, I think, an important question for you to consider. Could the future of private equity truly see the rise of these highly efficient, maybe one or two person firms competing right alongside the traditional multi-partner platforms, all powered and amplified by AI? Something to think about.